What do you think about the Laker team now?
You follow the box scores of the games every day?
Just the Lakers.
You're kidding. That is really a compliment. I was pleased to see you smile at the top of our show, because once the game starts, you have a game face. You don't smile much out there.
I don't think you have to do things for money anymore.
Correct.
What's up, Laker fans? Welcome to the Laker Film Room Podcast. I'm Pete, joined by Darius and D. Last night, our Lakers fell down 3-0 to the OKC Thunder in a series that's becoming more and more a Groundhog Day type of series. Once again, they were ahead at halftime. Once again, OKC really opened it up by the third quarter. And once again, by halfway through the fourth, it was over for sure. D, what are your thoughts on Game 3?
This, to me, is what happens when you play an opponent that is just better than you. I think that there's two ways to look at this, that there's a clear difference in quality between these versions of the teams. I think even with Luka, OKC is a better team. They've proven that over the last two seasons. So I don't want to go down that road at all. But the Lakers have a resiliency to them and a quality to them that I think is important to sort of establish and use as a foundation for what their ideas are going to be beyond this series. And I think we'll get into this more over the course of this pod, the next pod, and then over all of the offseason pods.
Yeah.
But over the span of, 12 quarters now, the Lakers have hung in there pretty well for 5.5 of them, 6 of them. They have some things to them that are competitive with the best team in the league. And taking a lead into both of these halftimes establishes an idea that the Lakers, even when they're not playing their best basketball, and that they're able to limit another really good team and also sort of scratch out their own positives within the context of a game to show we can make hay against a good team. The second part of this, though, Pete, is that when the other team is better than you, they can then make adjustments, and then they can play a little bit harder, or they can execute a little bit better, and then suddenly the difference starts to show and pile up and then pile on, and then they're ahead.
Absolutely. One of the things I always talk about is how the coaching battle in series basketball is somewhat of a card game. And one of the biggest places to be able to play your cards as a coach is during those halftime adjustments. And OKC has more cards to play than the Lakers do. And I think that's kind of what ends up happening in those third quarters to a degree. It's like, you know, Lakers tried a couple new things in that first half that a couple of them worked and then they shut it down. So, for example, Austin had like 8 assists in the first half, and then they very much changed their coverage on him in the second half, and he had 1 assist to DA with like 10:50 left in the third, and then not again. And so just you see that over and over throughout these games where it's like, oh, this thing wasn't going so well for OKC. They have the answer for it. They can play a card, and then by the third quarter, you see a real difference.
Yeah, I thought Rui's production was very similar in
great
this
point.
Way, right?
They can shut it off.
Mm-hmm. That they were like, okay, this is what they're doing. Getting downhill with Austin, they're driving, kicking the Rui. We want to stay more attached here. We want to close out in this specific way. Not only do they have the ideas, they have the players to execute.
Right.
And credit to their players, not only can they execute, they continue to actually do it on the basketball court over and over and over again. And this is the quality of their team. OKC's ability to say, yeah, guess what? We are going to play Joe more in this game when he didn't play as much last game. And we're actually going to lean into AJ Mitchell more as an on-ball player because he clearly has it going.
Mm-hmm. And then Jared McCain plays like 9 minutes, whereas a couple games ago, he was one of those guys that was putting up 18 points.
Yeah, and in the second half, they went back to their too big look for another important and extended stretch and said, no, we are making hay with this specific lineup. We're going to go back to it. And this very much reminds me, I think OKC is a better team than this version, but it reminds me of the 1920 Lakers in that those Lakers had a too big look. They had a single big look with like Dwight or JaVale. And then they had a single big look with AD. And then with LeBron and then Rondo and then some of the, like the more offensively geared units that had Kuz in them or the defensively geared units that had like Danny Green and KCP or Avery Bradley.
Caruso. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Lakers just were like, yeah, guess what? We're shutting your water off. Oh, no, guess what? We're going on an offensive run. Oh, no, guess what? We are huge. And we've got LeBron and Kuz and AD and Dwight Howard all on the court at the same time. And other teams didn't have the versatility and the looks to match up with that. And those Lakers could poke and prod, and over the course of a game, or particularly a playoff series, could say, whatever you thought was going to work, it's not anymore, because we've got better solutions.
Well, and if they do find something that works for them, they can hammer it over and over in a way that, like, it takes sometimes a little while to figure things out. That's been one of my takeaways, is that they figured out our defense about a game and a half into this series in a way that they are just scoring at will from that point on. That I think there are so many takeaways from the, and I really want to skip ahead to the, so what do you learn from this series type of portion of it, that we're going to have so many pods about that, that I'm trying to restrain myself a little bit. But one of the things that shone through for me is just, there is definitely a ceiling on the style of defense that we play, and you got to have the guys defensively to be able to, you know, pull off high level basketball. But just the number of looks, like one minor bit, and this is not something where I'm like, oh, if we only did this, we'd have won a game by now. But I would love for the team to get to a point where they actually use more zone in the playoffs, and that can go to kind of a number of different looks. We've done it here and there in this series, but yeah, just this switching type of defense, I think OKC has really burned. I think they've really put Austin and Luke under the basket a lot, in ways that it's not just like the, oh, you know, DA's out on the perimeter or something like that. There's a lot of rim protection possessions for our smallest guys. It's just a function of switching that much, right? This is one of the weaknesses of doing that, that if you were going to continue to play that way, you got to have guards that can kind of play above their heads around the basket, and then bigs who can move them puppies out on the perimeter, or you need a better roster defensively to be able to run more types of coverages. But either way, I think we've kind of hit our heads on our defensive ceiling pretty hard against them.
Yeah, there was a possession where Kennard, and he recognized it a little bit late, and this is how Kennard is, and so I don't want to act as though if he would have done something different, because doing something different would have been in some ways outside of his character. He did recognize, I've got to box out Isaiah Hartenstein here. And he armbarred him and tried to lock Hartenstein's arm, but Hartenstein basically just swim moved him. He looked like J.J. Watt or something, right? And he just moved him.
No chance.
And he got to the front of the rim and got an offensive rebound. But to your point, that's targeting Kennard in a way that has nothing to do with saying, go guard SGA, right? Now, they're doing that as well, but what they're really doing defensively is saying, Kennard, go have to box out or front or defend Hartenstein or Chet. And Austin, you're going to have to guard the point of attack pretty much on every single possession. And you've got an extraordinary lift offensively. And on defense, you're going to have to be the stopper. And when you talked about not having the players necessarily to defend, it was super interesting in the second half watching JJ basically oscillate between going away from Smart and then having to go back to him after the Lakers' defense looked like they weren't able to hold water.
One of the things that stood out in that first half, and I think there's hints of this throughout the series and even their regular season matchups, is the Lakers looked at their best when they had their best spacing out there. It was sort of a like, well, we're not doing great on defense anyway, so let's put Austin, Kennard, Rui, DA, and LeBron on the court. And then, yeah, Marcus will come in for one of those guys, but really trying to maximize sort of the offensive groups. And so I think that he was trying to lean into that to a degree.
Let's take a break here, Pete. And when we come back, I want to linger a little bit more on like sort of individual player deficiencies. And then I want to pivot to a guy that sort of, if not surprised me, I was happy to see him do well. So one of the reasons why I thought JJ was oscillating between like taking Marcus out and putting him back in is that offensively, he was, again, just very unreliable. I'm talking about Smart here. And This is the second game in a row where I thought his sort of decision-making as a passer was not very good, and his shot pass decision-making was not very good. And overall, his ability to impact the game offensively was relatively low. And to your point, JJ clearly recognized we look our best as a team when our offense is spaced and we've got our best offensive players out on the court, and they were getting enough stops to feel like, okay, maybe we're making some hay here. Here's a little bit of a run. We're like outscoring ahead them in the first half. Kennard's making threes. We're surviving this way. In the second half, when OKC tightened up and made their adjustments, the Lakers weren't able to score as effectively. And he was going back to Marcus because Marcus is really the only guy that can fight SGA 94 feet. He's really understanding, no high pickup points. I'm like denying you the ball. We're making it so that someone else has to initiate.
This is one of those dilemmas I talk about of how you actually beat someone in competition is you cause two separate problems that they have to choose between. And I felt like Redick was stuck in that spot.
They need a player who can defend close to Marcus's level, if not at Marcus's level. But they need that same player to be enough on offense to be a threat and hit shots. I think it's been clear that against this quality of team, that the Lakers don't have enough of those guys who can not only survive, but can thrive in a series that's at this high of a level. The other guy that I thought who had a very rough night in general, but particularly a second half, was Ayton. He had that really bad sequence when the Lakers went zone and he couldn't get a defensive rebound at all. And then he ended up, I can't remember who he fouled. Was it A.J. Mitchell who he just shoved in the back?
Who just shoved him? I think it was Mitchell, yeah. You know, yes, that was a rough play. Redick sat down and said, I can't play him. They caught that on camera. Doris Burke and Dave Pasch were all over him on the call. My one pushback against this is that if you watch that play and you can point to me to the Laker that's trying harder than DeAndre Ayton on that play, like you said, they're in a zone. That's a everybody's got to do their job type of rebounding situation. It's hard to rebound out of zone. The start of that sequence was DA actually contesting, jumping to contest a shot, landing, and then being a little late to get back. But he double jumped. Like, it wasn't an effort thing to start the play. By the end, he I'm not even really defending DA here. What I don't like is just the dogpiling on one person where he looked to me like the guy who was trying the hardest on that play, which wasn't very hard for sure, but he wasn't the only guy out there. Anyway, continue. Yes, he rightfully got benched and all that. I just, again, I think this is a team-wide problem that it's easy to scapegoat one person on.
Yeah, I think that the first offensive rebound the team gave up, it was actually A.J. Mitchell who went and got the ball. Whoever was the guard up top or who had box-out responsibilities against Mitchell, that was partially his fault as well. But Ayton got worn down.
Oh, yeah.
To me, it was symbolic that he got worn down physically and mentally over the course of that possession.
Yeah.
And his frustrations were clearly high.
And it's not just that play with DA as well. I think this series has shown sort of the difficulties that he would have even going forward against a team like OKC.
The hardest part about Ayton this series hasn't even been his competitive fire or his ability to rebound or defend even, although you pinpointed this before the series even started, that moving Ayton away from the guy that you're guarding is a hub of the offense and you have to be locked in because you're guarding the ball a bunch.
And he's right in front of you. That's all you got to pay attention to. There's not a bunch of crap whirling around. He's kind of big and slow. You know what I mean? It's like way more in his wheelhouse than this is.
Yeah, versus suddenly you're on the perimeter against Chet. You're having to monitor all their guards while keeping close enough to Isaiah Hartenstein to get a body. And you're in that gray zone a bunch and you have to have great defensive feel. This is not a great defensive role for Ayton over the course of a series. The part that has been disappointing, frustrating, whatever sort of word you want to use, is that he just hasn't been finishing to the level that he needs to finish against a physical and fast defense.
What do you think the reason for that is?
He looks sped up.
Agreed.
His chances are not as clean. OKC is a very physical team. They're physical not only with their bigs, but with their guards as well. And so Ayton, he reminds me of Dwight in this way, that the ball is often around his waist area or around his midsection. It's very different from a player like Powell or like the European players
keep
in general
high.
Stand
mm-hmm.
out to me this way. But he's almost always bringing the ball down, and then he's almost always then fighting a guard or a wing for a clean finishing opportunity. And Ayton, his hands are, I've always said that he has an understanding of how and where to catch the ball. I don't think his hands are very strong. So mm-hmm. if a guy hits his hand, he's losing the ball almost every single time. Mm-hmm. It's a different qualification of bad hands. Kwame Brown had bad hands. You'd throw the ball to him, it would hit his hands and he would drop it. Ayton catches the ball and then a guy hits his hands and it checks out of there like it's hitting a pinball rubber.
He does drop his fair share of passes too, though. I think part of it's a reaction time and processing speed thing too. But yeah, he needs ideal conditions for sure to hold on to that. And the point you made about him bringing the ball down, a lot of times that'll erase your advantage against a really high level defense, right? Is that window that you had to make that jump hook that you want to take, bringing it down and then bringing it back. If it doesn't get stripped when it's down low, by the time it's back up, the big guys, you know, got a chance to contest.
OKC probably also has like the toughest stable of guards in the league. Caruso and Wallace and Mitchell has that dog in him. Shea, even Dort, all these guys are just hounding him. Those two guys, Ayton and Smart, for starter level players. This series looks a little bit above both of their heads at this point, which is not something that I would have thought I was saying about Smart, but it's more on the offensive side of the ball for Smart. Defensively, he's hanging in there well, but offensively, you could tell that things are just in the mud a little bit too much when he's on the court and his decision-making has been shaky.
I can make a little bit of a stronger pro-Marcus argument going forward in that biggest problem with him on offense is that there's way too much of him. And if Luka were playing, it would push Marcus into a naturally lower usage role that is more appropriate to his game, in which the defensive things that he's provided and has been a big part of helping the Lakers limit Shea would shine through a lot more without the, oh God, can you believe that pass he just made type of moments, you know?
This is totally a fair point. And this is why I think the Lakers have learned many things in this playoff push. And playing it all without Luka, I think, has given them a certain understanding of the circumstances have been exactly the same from game one through what it is this now, it's about to be game 10 on Monday, that there are good takeaways here and there are things that I think that they can use. Let's take our second break here, Pete. And when we come back, I want to talk about a guy that I liked. And then I want to also wrap up on Austin and LeBron. I want to talk ado a little bit. Jake LaRavia was a DNP.
First game he missed all season, yeah.
Yeah, is that they gave ado a chance, and he played him in both halves. Pete, what'd you see from Thero?
He's more representative of an idea to me than him by himself, necessarily. Although him by himself, I view him as a really important test of the Lakers' player development, because when he's on the court with other legit players, he is exactly what the team needs. Now, they need it in a more mature player, a player who knows where he's supposed to be. I do see the things that would frustrate a coach, the like, where are you going? Why are you running to that spot or things like that? I think are partially just a function of how little that he's played. But the athletic force and pop that he has, he had 8 rebounds in, 13 minutes in that game. But really, it's just running. That's one of the biggest things from this series, D, is just the difference in how much they like to and do run just from spot to spot. And it's not just transition or anything like that, but there's just an athletic zip and force to him that made the whole group look better. And I don't think it's a coincidence that he had, a neutral plus minus. I think he had the best plus minus on the team, in part just because that's exactly what we need. I don't think you get his type of athleticism in many players. I don't think that's something that just through free agency, let's pick up 2 or 3 of dudes that actually know how to play basketball, because those guys are usually going to be making a good amount of money. But looking for really high level type of athletes and developing him himself is going to be super important going forward, because it was just like a breath of fresh air from an athletic standpoint to see the whole 5-man unit have a level of juice to it that just doesn't exist if you don't have that type of athlete in there. What do you see?
He didn't look out of place not only from the Lakers' perspective of like, okay, like you seem to be just as informed as any of these other dudes that are out here running around, right? Like, I'm sorry, like Maxi Kleba's how long has Kleba been in the league, right? And there were a couple of possessions where I'm just like, is he in the right place here? Is he doing what he's supposed to be doing?
He looked out of place, right? If you're talking about somebody who checked into the game and stood out like a sore thumb in a bad way, it was actually him, not a dude.
Yeah, he was like a step behind, a step slow, fumbled a couple of passes. And I was just like, okay, well, to be fair to Kleba, he hasn't played in a really long time. But from a dude's perspective, I was just like, well, okay, you seem to know what you're doing. You're competing hard. And athletically, what you were talking about did stand out in a positive way. Now look, he was far from perfect. First possession, it's a free throw rebound situation. He doesn't squeeze the pill. OKC comes in and blindsides him and takes the ball away. Offensive rebounding chance. I think OKC scored out of that situation.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, damn it. And I think I saw Vando or someone talking to him or Rui talking to him as the Lakers went to timeout. And they were sort of talking about like awareness and where to turn and holding the ball tightly and yada, yada, yada. Couple possessions later, he missed a defensive rebounding chance. But OKC missed their next shot, and then he swooped down from the top of the key and got a rebound where it looked like his head was at the rim. And I was just like, that's more like it. He had that play on a dive cut where LeBron hit him and like he missed a dunk and then got his own rebound and then got fouled. You would have loved to see the finish in the first place, but the explosiveness to get to that spot on the court and try to finish within traffic and then get your rebound. I just thought, okay, like he belongs from a physical standpoint out here. And if you can get him more reps and get him an understanding, I think that he can be very useful in the exact ways that you described. I was happy they gave him a chance and mostly fine with how he played. Moving forward, it will be useful to have a player of his archetype available. And I think that he shows enough ranginess as like a forward and enough athleticism as sort of like a small ball potential big guy that a lot of the ways that the Lakers use Vando, I see a very similar pathway to a Dew playing to that.
That was one of the things I was excited about. I don't know if you remember over the course of the summer, I was like, I think a Duke could be a small ball five in some really effective units because I think you could be really fast while still maintaining that lob threat. And I'd love to see them cultivate that over the course of the next year plus. And so excited to see Adu's development in summer league. Let's just hope he can stay healthy, right? I think that's the biggest reason why he's in this position and barely played this year is the two long stretches that he missed. He never really got the chance to get his feet under him. And let's hope he can do that going forward. D, we'd be remiss though if we didn't talk about LeBron and Austin. And let's start with Austin. I think we're going to have a lot of big picture conversations over the course of this summer. And I want to have one last small picture one, though, just zeroing in on this game. Game one, he was awful. Game two, he was really good. His best playoff game, particularly as an on-ball guy, I thought. And then game three was somewhere in between, but definitely not what you would need. I also think this series somewhat provides a simulation of what a Luka as the number one guy is. LeBron isn't Luka level anymore, but LeBron, I think, has been filling that number one option type of spot. And it simulates kind of what Austin's role would be going forward. And I don't think the returns have been particularly great. Again, we'll talk about that more and more. But beyond game one, game two, Austin's contract, any of that stuff, what did you see from his game in just this game?
I would say that I thought his playmaking was super high level, particularly in the first half, and that the passes that he's making are like really good passes and really good reads. I understand that the turnovers, there's too many of them. They were all over this on the broadcast, and I actually thought that they went too far, very similar to the way that you talked about how they were piling on with Ayton. I thought that they saw something in Austin's frustrations with the referees, and then they just kept piling on and on and on. Mm-hmm. Austin was frustrated with the refs for sure. In some of those instances, I think fairly. You said something at the very beginning there where you said that this simulates Austin's role. And I think that's somewhat true. LeBron is taking over the number one option, well, for the Lakers, but he is not handling the ball nearly as much mm-hmm. as Luka. Luka's the guy you give the ball to in the backcourt, and he sets up everything. And they are not giving LeBron the ball in the backcourt, barely at all. They're giving it to Austin or they're giving it to Marcus. And one of the things that is interesting to me is the number of times Austin is being put in like a go initiate offense for everyone right now, like over and over and over again against a top team. And I think that he would do that in certain shifts for sure with Luka back. But all the minutes that he would play with Luka, like that split would probably be 70-30.
Sure.
Towards Luka. You know what I mean? And that Austin would be more of a second side player.
Austin, I feel like for a lot of the year, has been tasked with being Luka Jr. Luka led the league in scoring. He led the league in usage rate. And I think that when you have a player that a team is so used to giving the ball to one guy as the, this is how we're going to get offense, that it's difficult to not play that way when they're not on the court too. So that's part of the reason why I think in Luka's previous stops, it's been Luka plus Jalen Brunson, Luka plus Kyrie Irving, is that if you're going to be really ball dominant through one player, you're going to do that. It's got to be like Donovan Mitchell in that second spot or someone like that. I asked to have a small picture conversation. Here I am talking about big picture stuff, but a big part of Austin's struggles to start that game, he started, I think, over 5 from the field, missing open jump shots. He had clean looks. He's just not that good of a jump shooter. He's a good overall player, but he's just not. And to be an on-ball guy like that, that's part of the reason why we struggle against the deep drops, is that's one of the things, shots that's open, that we're just not that great at hitting it.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because Austin's a very good free throw shooter, and free throw shooting is typically like one of the hallmarks for what your development as an actual shooter will be. It's one of the reasons why I still hold out hope for Austin eventually becoming the level of shooter that is good enough.
These are different type of shots, though, than a lot of free throw shots and three-point shooting can be. These are off the dribble. I just had to get away from Cason Wallace, and now I've got a 1-2 dribble pull-up. You know what I'm saying?
The ones he missed, though, in the first half, two of those first 4 threes that he took were spot-up threes.
Kickouts
off of LeBron touches. His shot quality was good enough where I'm like, these are bad misses because you can't miss all of those. So the on-ball scoring stuff, when you were talking about the Lakers playing differently, and this is where I'll zoom back in, is when Austin did start to find some stuff in the second half, it was coming off DHOs, coming off of pin downs. He was like curling into the basket and then he was drawing contact. He got an and one on AJ Mitchell, and that was on like a curl. Mitchell was late. Austin bodied him a little bit and threw up a little flip shot and got the and one. When you talk about being able to play differently, this is also a part of their playbook that it feels like they've abandoned a certain amount with Luka out, because they would run those same actions for Luka with Austin or LeBron as the initiator. And this is where the we have three of these guys becomes super helpful. And this is a part of their playbook that has almost been gone.
One of the things about this year is that we were supposed to have three. How often this year did we have three? And when we did, they went like 16-2 over the course of that month. Now, I don't think that necessarily translates, but we were never the team that we were supposed to be, right? That's supposed to be that third guy is sort of that, like, get you over the top. Like, yeah, you have enough for this guy and that guy, but now you've got a third guy you got to worry about. That can be tough.
Yeah, and OKC is equipped from a defensive standpoint to say, like, oh, no, well, okay, well, we'll play an all-defense lineup, and here's Wallace, Caruso, and Dort, and they're all on the court together, and we've got options for all of you. And I get it. That's why they're a great team. But in bringing it back to the Lakers, I thought when Austin did start to make hay against this specific defense, that it came in a very specific way. And Austin's versatility as a player shows that he can have success in these environments, but his pathway changes and it's more narrow. He's not good enough as an on-ball player to be like, give him the ball 60 times against this defense and put him up top and he can isolate and just play 1-4 flat, or you can play pick and roll offense just with him and he's going to score for you. I thought he did a good job of playing setup man in that environment, but not as a scorer. And so to your point, the be Luka Jr., well, I think Austin can do that against like 85, 90% of the league. Like, he was awesome at that this season. And if he stays healthy, he's an all-star. This last summit of team, in zooming back out a little bit, shows the importance of having your best actual player.
Sure.
Which is a guy the Lakers have not had. In shifting away from Austin for a second, I did want to comment on LeBron.
Yes.
Quietly, he did not have his best game. We talked a lot about Austin's frustrations with the refs. This was as animated as I've seen LeBron in a very long time when it came to how he was refereed. I think he started the game like 1-for-7 or 1-for-9 from in the paint.
Yep. First three quarters, 1-of-9 in the paint.
He just wasn't finishing at the basket, Pete. And this is a hallmark of LeBron. And he ended up with decent enough numbers. But overall, I was just like, man, in a game where the Lakers needed both of their guys on offense to sort of raise their level, I thought both of them were actually below their level.
They were.
Well, in many ways. And that's one of the reasons why they lost.
Certainly. And that finishing in the paint, I think, is crucial on a team that is really relying on him to do that a decent amount. I thought he's looked a little bit tired. I think that the pace of this series of the every other day has sort of worn him down. I think he's part of the reason kind of why we take a step back in the second half too, is just the pace that OKC forces you to play at that LeBron has not spent all year, really in the last couple of seasons, going through the 82 in a way that, oh, I'm used to playing this hard for this many minutes for obvious reasons at his age. But I've thought that the paint finishing has been a reflective of that. But really the finishing in around the basket, he's smoked more layups than ever. You see the little flickers of what Father Time has taken, even if he hasn't won all the way. And really, I feel like we've buried the lead, though. D, Monday might be the last game LeBron plays as a Laker. Wanted to get your thoughts on that before we go.
Yeah, it's something I'm honestly that I've been trying to like push to the side. I've long considered that this season would be his last season. When we came into the OKC series, I was not thinking of it from the context of, well, the Lakers are unlikely to advance, and what does that mean for LeBron? And now that we're a game away, I still actually haven't reckoned with that yet. I don't know how to feel about it, Pete. Throughout the Houston series and through the first three games of this series, even though I said that last night was not his best game, you talk about a dude showing, oh, well, he didn't look out of place. He looked like he belonged. In the Houston series, LeBron was the best player. And the Lakers have fallen apart offensively without LeBron on the court against OKC. Have they been good enough offensively with LeBron? Sometimes no, they haven't been.
But there's been a noticeable difference.
Part of it, too, is that he still has the force and athleticism and the skill and the mental acuity to say, I can beat what you throw at me. It's what makes him still a 16-game player. Whatever offseason discussions we have, regardless of, oh, is LeBron done or is he coming back or is he not or whatever, the idea of having that level of player who can sort of thrive in a playoff environment is something you never want to let go of. Mm-hmm. The thing about LeBron is that you don't just play 16 games. You play a whole season worth of basketball in order to get to these 16 games. And so that's the LeBron conversation we'll have to have at another time. But right now, I'm just appreciating what he's giving to the team. Is it perfect? It surely wasn't in game three. There were still those moments, though, where I'm just like, look at LeBron go. He still got something to him where he can pierce the other team's game plan. On both sides of the court, even defensively, he still has his moments, more than just his moments for sure. And I'm just appreciative of all that he's done this playoff series, all he's done as a Laker over all of these years. And honestly, like, I'm not ready to reconcile whether or not it's his time. You know what I mean?
I do. I don't have anything particularly articulate to say on the topic. I, again, just had the realization last night, like, Monday might be it. It's been 8 years. And just like, wow. So I'm going to try to digest that. We'll be back after Monday's game. Got game 4 on Monday night. We'll discuss how that goes and have a lot of conversations ahead about the offseason. But until then, you've been listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Baines has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn his double team. Just pass out of front, broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
There's Magic, got it. Magic fires. It's good. They will. The Lakers win the game!
Rebound of Lonnie. 3 seconds left. Van Exel to win it. It's on the way.
Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. Shaq with his eighth block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
right, in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe, hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal! Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane, back for Gasol, pretty pass, and it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move.
Two, one. Miss it.
Unbelievable.
It's over.
Shot clock now to five. Bryant.
Yes.
And that was a little tap to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis, 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good! Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers! James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.